The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Jessen, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Brian presiding. The first case is consolidated case numbers A210862 and 8210873, State of Minnesota versus Tyrese Eugene Roberson, defendant, Midwest Bonding LLC appellant.
And good morning to the attorneys again. I want to thank you for participating in these remote arguments. And even though we're not in person, the same rules apply as they would if we were at the Judicial Center. We also want to make a couple of comments. First off, we understand that from time to time, there may be interruptions. Pets, children, doorbells. I think Amazon Prime came in the middle of the argument last week. So we understand that from time to time, these things happen. We'll try to keep them to a minimum and ask you to do the same. Along those same lines, if for some reason there's a technical glitch, if we freeze or someone drops off, we will make sure that you receive all the time to which you're entitled. So we'll stop everything and let us know as soon as you observe a problem. We'll do the same, even if it means we're interrupting you. I want to remind you that the clock is one of the participants. So if you're in the gallery view, you should be able to see it just fine and know how much time is remaining. If you've toggled into active speaker view, you might not be able to see that clock very well. So that's one of the tips that we provide to the attorneys arguing, is to remember to stay in gallery view. Also, please stay muted when you're not presenting your argument. If there are other participants, they are not able to share their screens or make any comments. Unless they are the attorneys arguing or one of the judges on the panel. And with that, are we ready to proceed?
Appellant's ready, Your Honor.
All right, go ahead, Mr. McGinney.
Thank you, good morning. May it please the court, Ms. Pipenhagen. My name is Jim McGinney. I represent the appellant in this matter, Midwest Bonding LLC. We're here on appellant's notice of appeal of a district court order imposing a $162,500 penalty on the reinstatement and discharge of a forfeited bail bond, and in another file, a $4,000 penalty in the reinstatement and discharge of a bail bond. Both the criminal case files reference one defendant, Mr. Tyrese Roberson, who was ultimately convicted after a jury trial and sentenced, I believe, to a 360-month executed prison sentence on the file, I want to say ending in 2172, which was the larger bond at issue here, the $162,500 penalty. The $4,000 penalty that was imposed, I understood the matter was still pending at the time of the arguments. I'm not sure that what happened, the disposition of that file, but I know that the larger bond and that file is causing Mr. Roberson to serve his sentence. I'm sure this court's well familiar with the Forshetsky factors that need to be analyzed in these matters. I'm not going to take this court's time in reiterating and reciting those factors in the case law. It's all outlined in my brief. I don't ordinarily do this, but I'd like to start out pointing to a few flaws in respondents' conclusions and the district court's conclusions. To start off with, the district court in its order found that the fourth factor, the prejudice to the state factor, weighed against reinstatement. I argued at the hearing before the district court, I know Ms. Pipenhagen wasn't counsel for the state at that hearing, there was another attorney present. We argued at that hearing, and I reiterate this morning, that the state presented no evidence regarding prejudice in this matter. I know there was argument made, and the counsel for the Dakota County Attorney's Office talked about the costs incurred in treating Mr. Roberson for a gunshot wound and the costs incurred for having the jury gone for a half a day and the costs incurred in hotels and other expenses that they claim to have incurred as a result of Mr. Roberson's absconding. all amounted to prejudice to the state. As this court's, I'm sure, well aware, the Minnesota Supreme Court has held that the type of prejudice that needs to be shown, and I emphasize shown, is inability to prosecute the offender as a result of the absence from the court's jurisdiction.
I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. So from your perspective, inconvenience for the to the jury, you know, you have to go home, later come back, that wouldn't, should not constitute prejudice to the state under your reading of those cases. Is that correct?
I agree, Your Honor. I guess, yes, that's my argument. Jurors get inconvenienced all the time. Well, those of us who've tried cases, you know, all sorts of things happen during a jury trial that can create juror inconvenience. A juror could get sick. There could be an evidentiary issue that arises.
And if I may just stop you there, have you seen any cases? I didn't look as definitively as I suppose, as I'm sure you did. Has there been any cases addressing the inconvenience to the jury, impact on a jury, is whether or not that could count as some sort of prejudice?
I don't see, I'm not aware of a precedential case that makes that holding, Your Honor.
Could I ask you, follow up with one additional question on the
prejudice? Of course, that's why I'm here. Issue.
So when I looked at the district court's opinion, it said the court took judicial notice. So of a lot of this, I mean, have you seen other cases where the prejudice is based upon judicial notice? And if you have thoughts about the appropriateness of judicial notice or not, I would be interested in hearing them, Mr. McGinney.
Well, and I had an opinion not from this panel recently where the district court made findings on its own, I guess, without the respondent or the state presenting any evidence at the hearing. And respectfully, I disagree with that practice, although my client didn't authorize us to petition for review to see what the Supreme Court would think of that practice. I disagree. I don't think it's the district court's job to make findings via judicial notice of things that aren't necessarily in the record or have not been produced in the contested hearing. This is a civil proceeding.
Right, but Mr. McGinney, I want to interrupt because I think the question was, what authority is there for that argument? So if you could tell us the authority that you'd rely on, it's because you're now making that argument to us.
Sure.
Even if you didn't petition for review of that case, you're still asking us to reach the same conclusion about the propriety of using judicial notice.
Certainly.
So what's the authority that says district courts can't do that?
Well, I would cite State v. Askland, Your Honor, where the Supreme Court has said that the burden's not on the district court to prove claim prejudice, the burden's on the state. And so the state carries a burden of proof, and I would argue that Askland implies there's also a burden of production there. And for the court to take judicial notice is the court's, and I don't know, I can cite a specific authority to this, but judges shouldn't make findings on evidence that hasn't been received and what they think the evidence showed. That's the court making findings on evidence that's not been produced or what they presume the evidence was. So the judicial notice practice is my recollection, and I didn't brief this, but I think that the rule on judicial notice is that the courts can take judicial notice of previous findings of fact that were made by another judge in a case after hearing evidence. So to take judicial notice of what the judge observed in a courtroom or what the judge believed they observed during the proceedings doesn't satisfy the requirement under Askland for the state to prove prejudice. And even if it did, in this case, juror inconvenience isn't the type of prejudice that we're talking about in the Chesky factors to justify. And frankly, you know, I know the state, and I'm getting off track a little bit here. I hope I answered your question, Judge Bryan, about judicial notice. But I think it's the state's burden, again, of production. Otherwise, why would the state participate ever? They just need to let the court make those findings without presenting any evidence.
So, Mr. McGinney, I was trying to direct you back to Judge Jessen's question. So I'm not sure if that's sufficient or if you wanted to follow up, Judge Jessen.
Well, Mr. McGinney, you were saying that judicial notice, you were referring to judicial notice of inconvenience to the jury. And I think I had two separate questions. One was, would inconvenience to the jury be count as prejudice? But I think, as I recall, the district court's judicial notice was of the fact that the jury was paid an extra day, the presentation of the case, the state's case was disrupted. So there were more concrete actions.
Well, I'll address them both. I don't necessarily think that even if it's appropriate for the court to take judicial notice of a half day delay in the jury's had to, from the record, it appears the jurors were sent home for half a day. That doesn't amount to the prejudice to impose a $162,000 penalty in the reinstatement order. And as far as the district court and respondents' arguments that because they had to address this tricky legal issue about what to do in the defendant's absence, that's not the type of prejudice either. The state was able to and continued to prosecute this case, although they claim that it was inconvenienced that they had to have a witness testify by Zoom rather than in person. There's nothing in the record that shows that that witness testifying by Zoom caused any impediment in the prosecution. They obtained a conviction in the defendant's absence. So it seems counterintuitive to say my prosecution was prejudiced when they obtained a conviction. There's no showing of prejudice other than the fact that that witness testified by Zoom rather than in person. I think the district court noted that in its order as well. But again, that's not the type of prejudice that the Supreme Court's looking for. The type of prejudice is, you know, like the inability to prosecute the defendant because they've not been apprehended, like in Vang, or the inability to prosecute a defendant because evidence has been lost by the length of the defendant's absence. Here, while the defendant was absent somewhere between 10 and 12 days, I guess the record's a little murky about that, but that's not a very long time. Really, there was only a half a day delay in the case. Apparently, the defendant didn't show up. The court recessed the next morning. They started the trial up again and completed the trial in absentia, which is appropriate to do. I've had that happen in my practice when an offender absconds during trial. They go forward with the trial without the defendant present. The defendant waived his right to appear, but it didn't prejudice the state in a way that would justify the penalty that's being imposed in this case. And I would like to address that briefly because the state indicates, or a respondent indicates, that it's not the amount of the penalty, but the percent. And I would bring this court back to Schatzky, where the purpose of bail is not to punish the surety, and the purpose of forfeiting a bond isn't to punish the surety or to increase the revenue of the state. Both those things are occurring here by this draconian penalty. The surety.
If I can get you back to the discussion we were having a bit earlier, is it your argument then that there's some binding case law or authority that says when a trial proceeds in absentia, there is no prejudice to the state?
I don't know that that's necessarily the holding that I'm looking for, but I think that applying the facts of the case, that the standard or the requirement for prejudice is an inability or a hindering, I think is the language that Asklin used, the court in Asklin. The state's ability to prosecute the defendant needs to be impeded or hindered by the absence of the defendant. And that's not the case here. The defendant's absence did not prevent the state from prosecuting this case.
But that's the question, I think, is how could it ever impact the state if the trial proceeds in absentia? Isn't that sort of by definition, it would never impact the state or hinder the state?
Probably not.
So then what's the authority for that proposition? Are you asking us to go out and be that case that hasn't happened before? Or is there some other authority that says on the prejudice grounds in that analysis, if it proceeds in absentia, that factor weighs in your favor? What's that case? Or are you asking us to be that case?
No, I think both Asklin and Storkamp from the Supreme Court both hold that, and I'll cite from Storkamp, the prejudice to the state factor in Schatzky analysis is concerned solely with prejudice to the state in prosecuting the defendant. So if the state's able to...
Right, I'm asking specifically about whether there has been that rule applied in when a trial proceeds in absentia.
I'm not aware of any case law, Your Honor, that where this fact scenario has presented itself. But I think applying the holding from Shetsky, Storkamp, and Asklund, if the state's able to prosecute the defendant in absentia, then they've not been prejudiced. Now, that's not to say that there's cases where maybe the defendant, his absence creates some difficulty and they're not able to complete the trial without him. And I suspect respondent's going to go into the sentencing argument that was made in their brief about the fact that because he absconded from the trial, it delayed the sentencing. I would just point again to the burden of production and proof here that there's been, it's purely argument that happened. There's been no evidence presented.
If I could follow up on that point, because you make the same point in your brief, that these are arguments the state made as opposed to evidence. What would be, in your view, the proper way that it should have happened? Should they call the law clerk and ask the law clerk questions about why the trial proceeded in absentia, or to lay some specific evidence in the record, some testimony that the trial proceeded in absentia? I mean, all the judge knew it. Everyone in the courtroom knew that it proceeded that way. And why do you need something more than argument to talk about that kind of prejudice?
Well, I don't know that they could present any evidence that they were prejudiced if the trial proceeded to a successful conviction. There's no evidence that they would be able to present. But if they were going to argue that they've been prejudiced, they would call a police officer who could say, our evidence locker was locked the next day for whatever reason, and I wasn't able to obtain an exhibit because your defendant wasn't here yesterday. And or the officer who was going to present that exhibit or lay foundation for this testimony isn't available now because the defendant, because we had a 2-day delay or whatever the length of the delay was caused by the absence. You know, the most common one, of course, is the defendant's never apprehended and is not prosecuted. And that's easy to, you know, the evidence of that is easy to present. But they could call witnesses, their witness victim coordinator, to say we lost track of a witness. They could file an affidavit from their victim witness coordinator saying we're unable to reach a witness or the witness no longer wants to cooperate. You know, there's some reference to the victim's family being fearful while the defendant was at large here, but there was no evidence presented of that. But that might be, you know, if you had witnesses who were fearful because an offender was not present and they wouldn't come back and testify at the ongoing trial in absentia, you could certainly make a record of that, present a victim witness coordinator who could testify to that kind of fact. And I see I'm out of time, so I'll reserve for rebuttal any more questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Pippenhagen. I'm sorry, you're still on mute.
Happens every day.
It happens to me every day as well. Okay,
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. Good morning, Your Honors and Mr. McGeaney. My name is Heather Pippenhagen, and I am an assistant Dakota County attorney here on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota in this case. And I would submit to Your Honors that the district court in this case did not abuse its discretion when it forgave half of the penalty in this case and only imposed a 50% penalty as occurred. And like Mr. McGeaney, I'm not going to go through all four Shetsky factors again. I know they're in our briefs and this court's very familiar with them, but I think it's worth noting one thing, and that is burden. The first three Shetsky factors, the petitioner who is asking to have the entire bond forgiven has the burden on the first three Shetsky factors. The state then has the burden on the fourth Shetsky factor to prove prejudice. I was going to go through each of them individually, but I think at this point, I just want to skip right to prejudice just because there was so much discussion about that when appellant was arguing. The district court in this.
Ms. Pippenhagen, before you get to your argument as to which way that factor weighs, my question is, let's assume the panel concludes that neither one of you has carried your burden, right? So the first three, appellant hasn't established that those weigh in his favor, that there was error. And on the fourth, we conclude that the state did not establish prejudice. Is there some guidance as to how much that fourth factor weighs Is it equal? Is it just a totality? Is 3 versus 1?
I don't know the answer to, I'd have to think about the answer to the first part, whether or not they've met their burden on the first three. There are many, many appellate court cases, and had I anticipated this question, I would have given you a cite, but it's clear that the state doesn't have to prove any prejudice. There's cases where the state remained silent and didn't prove any prejudice, and the court still found that the district court didn't err when it imposed a penalty. So the state doesn't have to do anything on number four. Obviously, that weighs into the analysis of all four of the facts, and it carries more weight if we prove prejudice, sure. But it's not dispositive if the state does not prove prejudice. I think the court analyzes all four factors as a whole, and whether or not the petitioner has carried any burden on the first three factors when it's determining whether or not the district court abused its discretion. But I think it's important to note on the prejudice prong in this case, the district court made some findings about the prejudice to the state, things like the jurors being inconvenienced, having to be paid extra, the trial being delayed. And the court did include this in the prejudice section on their order. I think those are valid things to consider, but in my opinion, they're more appropriately under number one. And I think I addressed this in my brief. The first Shetsky factor is the purpose of bail. And the purpose of bail is to prevent the delay of proceedings, the impairment of proceedings, or burdening the administration of justice. So all of those things are the purpose of bail. And those, I think, more accurately cover what Judge Taylor was referencing when she made those findings. She included them in the prejudice section. More properly under the first factor, what is the purpose of bail? To not have trials delayed, to not have jurors inconvenienced, to not pay jurors more, all of those kinds of things. So where does that leave us in the prejudice section? You know, what's left for prejudice for the state as far as the court's findings? And then the question for this court, if you move those items out, is there anything left to support the district court's finding on prejudice? The district court found that the state had minimally met its burden on prejudice. So, the question is, when you look at what's left, what does the state have that shows prejudice? I would submit that there was a number of issues that had to be litigated because of the defendant's absence. And that is probably the entirety of what I can give you to establish prejudice. There was, and it's not a slam dunk. I know Mr. McGinney said, oh, it's normal. We just continue in absentia. We do that all the time in criminal cases. Well, you can tell from the record, that wasn't such a given. I mean, that was heavily litigated in this case. So there were three different issues. Do we proceed in absentia? I believe the defendant was asking that they not proceed in absentia. There was the issue of how do you deal with witnesses that are now unavailable because they traveled from out of state. Now we have, do we have confrontation clause issues with them testifying remotely? As this court is probably aware, this case, the criminal case is on appeal at this point. The other issue is how do you deal with this in the instructions to the jury? How do you deal with explaining the defendant's absence in the instructions to the jury? So there was all kinds of things that had to be litigated and are potential problems now in this prosecution. That is probably the most significant thing that I would say created a prejudice in the prosecution. The one other issue I just want to highlight, and I didn't see that appellant put this in his brief, but I think he emphasized it multiple times as his argument today, is that, well, a defendant was ultimately convicted. I think this court knows, and the case law is really clear, starting with Shetsky and then many cases after Shetsky, the ultimate finding of guilt or innocence in a case is immaterial to the Shetsky analysis. That's not something that the court considers in determining whether or not the district court abused its discretion in imposing the penalty. So, I mean, that's all.
Ms. Weipenhagen, I have a question on sure. that subject. And I agree, the district court did say that the state minimally met its burden of proving prejudice. The court does not rely heavily on this factor, et cetera. But then we have this massive forfeiture for the minimal meeting of prejudice on which the court didn't heavily rely. Ought we to consider the minimal showing of prejudice in assessing whether the district court abused its discretion in arriving at this massive amount?
Well, and again, there's three other factors that need to be considered. And again, the case law is clear that even if the state shows no prejudice, you can still forfeit a bond, and you can forfeit the entirety of the bond even without prejudice. So then I would move to those other three factors. And I think the other three factors did strongly weigh in favor of some penalty in this case. And I outlined them in my brief. So I don't know if you want me to go through them again. I mean, obviously the purpose of bail was not satisfied here because the trial was delayed. You know, it was not delayed significantly, but it certainly was delayed. The good faith surety is measured by fault of the defendant. It's pretty clear in this case, and I think appellant conceded at the district court level that he had willfully absconded. That is attributed to the surety. And then you have the efforts of the surety to find him. You know, I think this court should be concerned that it wasn't until after he didn't show up for court that the surety even realized they didn't have adequate contact information for him on a case with these high of stakes. Their efforts, there were no efforts on the part of the surety that resulted in the apprehension of the appellant. It was law enforcement that found the appellant in another county. So,
and of course, on that subject, that the trial was already over by the time he was apprehended. So really, at the point in time when your prejudice, to the extent there was prejudice, occurred, they really didn't have any opportunity unless they had some sort of a dragnet that they could send out on a moment's notice.
Well, and I don't think prejudice stops at trial. I mean, prejudice can carry all the way through sentencing and impact on victims. And I'm not alleging that that occurred in this case, but I don't think the analysis of prejudice ends at the trial. But certainly the surety did nothing to apprehend the defendant in this case. And, you know, those are what the Shetsky case tells you to look at. And so you look at those three factors, and we just don't have anything where they've really met their burden in this case. Now, to get to your question about, I think, you know, you said the large dollar amount. It is a large dollar amount. And this is why. And I think just from a policy reason, it's important to remember this. The business of bail bonds, as opposed to a defendant who poses cash bail, they show up, they get all their bail back. If you want a bond, this is a risk-based business. So high stakes offenses with high public safety risk, high flight risk on behalf of the defendant, they have higher amounts of bail. And so a surety knows this going into a case when they decide to insure a large bond. And the way the business works is they take that on a percentage. And so what's on the table for them? Huge profit if everything goes well, huge loss if things don't go well. And that was the business risk they took in this case. So when you look at it, it's a 50% penalty. If this was a car theft case with a $5,000 bond, they'd be out $2,500 and we probably wouldn't be here. But this was a case with a huge amount of bail, a huge amount of risk, huge potential for profit for the surety if everything goes well, but it didn't go well. And so the court imposed a 50% penalty. I submit to you that that was not an abuse of discretion and that was fair. Now, does 50% come up to be a fair amount of money? I'm not going to say $162,000 isn't a lot of money, but it's still 50%. And the point is, do we want the surety to pay more attention on cases like this? We do. We want the surety to pay more attention in cases like this. And there is no motivation for them to do that if they're only on the hook for the same amount of money that they'd be on the hook on a checkboard. So yes, it's a lot of money, but the stakes were high all the way around in this case. So I ask you to look at the percentage. And if it was another case and 50% penalty was imposed, would you find that unreasonable? And also, Shetsky, the analysis, the Shetsky analysis, that goes to whether or not the district court abuses its discretion in choosing to forgive some of it or not forgive some of it. There isn't really a lot of guidance as to how reasonable that percentage is. There really isn't a lot of guidance on that issue. The Shetsky case clearly, and I think I included this in the argument in my brief, and it's in case law also, says that the court has to weigh the Shetsky factors to determine whether to exercise its discretion to forgive or reduce the penalty. So the statute goes on to say, as the court considers just and reasonable. And I really couldn't find any cases that say, once you've analyzed the Shetsky factors to determine whether or not a bond should be reinstated or partially reinstated, what determines what's just and reasonable? So do we just look at the same Shetsky factors that we looked at in determining whether or not to reduce? I don't know. I submit that probably makes the most sense. And in this case, the first three Shetsky factors, I think, make it not an abuse of discretion for the court to have imposed a 50% penalty. So other than, I guess, going through in detail the analysis on Shetsky factor 1, 2, and 3 in my brief, which I won't do unless you have any questions about it, I would rest on my brief on that issue. And unless the panel has any other questions, I would forfeit the remainder of my time.
Thank you very much, Ms. McGinney. You may proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to reply to a few things, I think it's inaccurate to say that appellants didn't do anything in an attempt to locate and apprehend Mr. Roberson. The efforts are outlined in the affidavit, and as Judge Rodenberg pointed out, this defendant was apprehended a very short time after his failure to appear. And there's a lot more resources available to law enforcement than there are to the bail bond agency in their attempts to apprehend. So I think that is important to note that it was such a short amount of time. The purpose of bail under Shetsky is for the prompt administration of justice. And, the fact is high risk or high reward argument, I think, is not applicable to these analyses. But there's no evidence in the record here that that didn't occur, that there was not a prompt administration of justice to Mr. Roberson. You know, counsel says the matter was heavily litigated. There's nothing in the record to show litigation here. In fact, the trial commenced the next day. Now, it may have been argued at the bench or whatever, but there's no evidence of ongoing litigation involving the decisions that needed to be made. I'm sure this court's aware that it's certainly appropriate to try a defendant in absentia. Defendants fail to appear for trial all the time. That's true. The fact that in this case it was a serious felony as opposed to a DWI shouldn't make that much of a difference in the analysis, other than the fact, as the court points out, that the penalty here is more than $150,000. I would point to what I believe is error in the district court's findings. The state says they're not required to prove prejudice. Well, that's just not what the law is in this matter. The Supreme Court has clear that the burden is on the state to prove prejudice. And while there may be opinions of appellate courts that affirmed the denial of reinstatement of a bond when prejudice wasn't proven, that doesn't change the analysis here. And the district court saying the state minimally met their burden. How could the court make a finding that there was a minimal meeting of a burden when there was no evidence presented? None.
Well, it was just a minute. Wasn't it the same judge that had presided at the trial?
It was.
Well, I guess we're getting back to a subject I believe Judge Bryan may have asked about, but what more would they have done? Call the judge who already knew what the arguments were? I'm not following that line of reasoning.
Well, I guess maybe I didn't argue correctly. My point is there was no prejudice. There's no way to prove what that didn't exist. They couldn't prove prejudice in this case because there was none. And the court making a finding that they mentally met their burden when they didn't present any evidence, it's illogical for the court to make that finding when there was nothing produced by the state to show they were prejudiced.
To be fair to the district court, the court expressly indicated that it did not rely heavily on that factor in any event.
And I agree, Your Honor, and that's why it's unreasonable and abuse of discretion to impose this huge penalty when the court minimally relied on that.
Is the penalty, that gets back to the question I was asking of counsel for the state, does the penalty imposed have to somehow be commensurate dollar for dollar with the prejudice that the court can find?
Well, to answer your question, I think you asked counsel this question. I think the prejudice factor is the most important one because that goes directly to the prompt administration of justice. And I think that the penalty shouldn't necessarily be commensurate with the prejudice, but the case on its entirety. In other words, you know, this is a case, this isn't a case where the defendant was absent for 11 months or 15 months and yet you had all these other issues. So when you take the entire case, the facts of the case, the defendant absent for 11 days, the trial proceeding right away afterwards, and I think it is important that they obtained a conviction to show that they weren't hampered in their ability to prosecute, which is the prejudice standard.
I might have misheard something you said at the outset of that response, but maybe you can clarify. It sounded like you were saying that the prejudice goes to administration of justice. In other words, that the fourth Chetsky factor is actually the same thing as the first Chetsky factor. So maybe you can clarify what you meant by drawing that connection to the language of the first Chetsky factor. And I see your time has expired, but you can go ahead and answer the question.
Certainly. I think the difference is the first factor is the purpose of bail. And that factor is more in line with this court's published opinions about the length and cause of the defendant's absence, where the prejudice deals with the ability to prosecute the defendant. And the ultimate test under Chetsky, before they discuss any of the factors, is the purpose of bail being the prompt administration of justice. And so I believe that the prejudice factor addresses that more appropriately when there's a short period of absence. We're here that the proceedings commenced the next day, even though the offender was gone for 10 days. You know, if you look at all the cases, this court analyzes the purpose of bail, it's the length of the defendant's absence. Here it's unique because even though he was gone for 11 days, the case proceeded the next day. Really, you could analyze this as the defendant gone for half a day. So it's our position that the administration of justice is more related to prejudice than purpose or length of the defendant's absence in these cases where it's a really short amount of time.
Thanks. Are there any other questions from the panel? No. Okay. Well, I want to thank the attorneys for their arguments today and their written submissions. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an order within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you, everyone.